good evening out there, brothers and sisters in Blog Talk Radio Land. Mike Dugan here with you, and we are just going to talk tonight with my good friend Dave Gallagher, my partner in crime. Mike Galliano is away with his beautiful bride, Ann, and having some family time. So my dear friend Dave and I are just going to talk a little bit tonight about training. It's kind of just going to be a free-flowing discussion of some of the things going on. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my friend Dave. Lieutenant Dave Gallagher is a third-generation firefighter. He started as a volunteer fireman in Dayton, Ohio in 76, spent nearly 30 years with several metro Dayton fire departments. He joined the Huber Heights, Ohio Fire Division as a firefighter paramedic starting in 79 and retiring in 2004, where he served as a training officer, a hazmat tech, and with the spec ops. He instructed the hot in the classroom at FDIC. He taught at the Firehouse magazine shows. He was also instructor at the Massachusetts Fire Academy. And he's taught all over the country with other national trainings and conferences. He's a pro boarder certified instructor level 2. He specializes in forcible entry, rapid intervention, and survival, suburban ops, tech, truck company operations, and especially truck company operations with short staffed, because he came from a department that didn't have the manpower that some of us, like myself, had. He's been published in various trade magazines and done a ton of podcasts. So welcome, my brother, Dave Gallagher. How are you this evening, bro?
Brother, Brother Mike, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. Gets weird sometimes. I think maybe I've forgotten about some of that stuff. But we go way back, and it's always great to think about the past that we've shared, stuff that we've done together. And it's just awesome to be here. I can't thank you enough for letting me fill in for the legendary Mike Galliano. He's a good friend. You know, he and I chatted a couple of times about different things, and he remembers vividly back in, you know, San Diego when we met the Fab Four and how they just kind of integrated into everything, and he was always so thrilled to talk about those early days. But I'm thrilled to be here this evening. Hope I can contribute something. And yeah, let's see how this goes, because we know without the training, then not a lot gets done. So hopefully we'll do some good stuff for some people tonight.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, you can call in if you have any questions. The phone number, and I've got to look it up because I don't remember it. You can call in at 1-760-454-8852, and we will take your questions. And again, please, if you have anything you want to say, you can also put it in the chat box on the Fire Engineering. So we hope we hear from you. If not, we hope when you're listening to this during your workout or whatever else, you are enjoying the conversation and enjoying the talk of training. And training is someplace where Dave and I connected many, many years ago when we first met at FDIC in the late 90s. And we've always believed in training, and we've always believed in the importance of training and good training. It's what makes good firemen. So,
you know, what you just said there, Mike, good training. And I think that is the crux of the issue. I was recently fortunate enough to get asked by the South Florida Fools down here. They centered out of Hollywood to do some training with them last week, did some force military stuff. Couple great speakers that did some other things as far as, you know, VES and search and the critical part of this. And what I am thrilled to see is a lot of the the people out there swinging from the me mentality to the them mentality. And I think they just kind of needed permission to do that. But one of the things when I was doing my presentation, I saw a while back my grandson, who's in the Navy, and he was on leave. He's on the Eisenhower. We went to see Top Gun Maverick when he came down to visit. And one of the scenes that caught me, you know, art imitating life, was the part where he's having a little dissertation with the character John Hamm plays, Cyclone. And he says, you know, these are the best fighter pilots in the world. And the Maverick character says, yeah, because we've told them so, because they're in fighter planes bombing from high altitude and they're doing no dogfighting, but they're supposed to be the best fighter pilots in the world. Is the training sustaining what we actually expect of the line firefighter? And I thought that was very poignant, and I grabbed that and I put it in my presentation, because I think we're letting, and you and I both seen this countless times, you know, you were a metro ghetto firefighter, I was a suburban firefighter, and we've both seen where if you're not doing it real, it's going to affect the outcome when you do have to do it for real, you know, to the best of our ability. You know, we're certainly hindered by some things, but man, you know, forcing a door in just gloves and a helmet is certainly different than forcing a door with a mask on and smoke blowing through and zero visibility. I mean, you know that better than anybody.
And being
able to get a sense of reality in what you're actually having to do and actually having to address is huge.
Agreed. And very honestly, I think the idea of telling people that, you know, the propane fires is what they can expect in the real world is not realistic. It's not good for our profession. And I think what we have to do is figure out a way to show these young men and women what to expect in a fire. And very honestly, as a captain in a ghetto fire company, we got new kids from the fire academy. But the first time you crawl down a hallway with at a job, you know, do you have them hooked or not? Some of them, you've got them hook, line, and sinker. I mean, they took the bait all the way down.
Oh, yeah.
And they are, you've got them for life. They're hooked. And there's nothing better than understanding that. But again, the training has to reflect what we do. Forcing a door that is held with pieces of lath or something else, I mean, is good to get a feeling for the tools and the communication and everything else. But it's nothing like forcing a door that we've screwed shut with a metal lock plate, simulate a lock on both sides of the door, and making them force the door. And,
well,
you know, great fire. Go ahead.
Yeah, I remember visiting you at 234 and 123, and in order to get into the workout room, you had to force the door. You know, it was C-channel,
yep.
It was stainless steel screws, real doors. And to your point, the props are great for positioning, communication, and learning, you know, how much effort you have to put into it, being able to move the fork of the Halligan, being able to move, you know, a pair of you doing that. I mean, you had that. My world, it would have had to have been probably most likely one person, but nonetheless, we get good at forcing props, to your point. And the aspect of what we can expect an actual door to do and actually expect a building to behave when we're taking our recruits and putting them in concrete burn buildings, nothing's falling on them, You know, it may be banked to the floor, but again, to your point, propane and fake smoke, even if you are in a Class A burn building, there are limitations to it. And it's the old, oh, you know, shut that line down because I don't have to reset the room because you're going to get everything wet. So,
right.
And as I was mentioned to you before, somebody who has become a very dear friend and a significant contributor to my life, and I think I've learned so much from him. But Joe Minahan out of Boston, we've had the opportunity to get to know each other when I was teaching for the Mass Fire Academy. Those of you who may recognize the Minahan name, you need to look up Steve Minahan, find out the history of that. That's a homework assignment. Joe takes training incredibly passionately because it cost his family dearly. He knows what the risks are. He knows what that ultimate sacrifice is all about. And recently, he's been involved in an effort, along with a number of other good friends at the Mass Fire Academy, in starting to do rapid intervention under live fire conditions, along with Rusty Ricker and the New England Fools and all that. And it's like he said, man, even in training, when you're doing it under live smoke, live fire, following standards, it's a whole different ballgame. It's a whole different ballgame than, you know, dragging somebody across the bay floor. It's with the conditions being a lot more than they are. And I, you know, can't thank him enough for his passion that he develops in the fire service. I mean, he's a chief now, but boy, he has that passion, and I'm thrilled that he can, instead of just, you know, affecting your partner or affecting your crew, he can affect a lot of people with that passion. Kind of like you were talking about, getting them hooked, you know, getting them, that first one. I remember vividly, we had in our small town, and at the time, we not only had a core group of full-time, we had some part-time people as well that would come in and work, you know, 6, 12, 18, 24 hours, et cetera. And I had a Vietnam vet and took him to his first working fire, and it was a good one. And he was hooked beyond belief. He couldn't get enough of it after that. I mean, and this guy did, you know, tours in Nam. And I'd been shot at and wounded and everything else. And, man, he was all about it. And by the same token, we had the people that you could just tell all they wanted to do was ride the medic. So being able to discern that and figure out how we can expose people to what the realities are instead of what they think they are, if we don't do that, I think we do a disservice to those people coming in.
Totally agree, brother. Totally agree. And, I mean, we have to make sure that we make this as realistic and as – now, you're never going to have the same feel in a concrete burn building as in the real world. But you can make it similar. And the companies are going to train the people. I guess sad, scary, whatever it is, part of the training is, unfortunately, a lot of times our newer members of the fire service don't go to our busiest houses because the men and women on the department who have been here a while want to work in those houses because they like it so much. So a lot of times we send our young people to some of the slower companies in the organization. And what happens is, the the training in a lot of those places is not up to what you and I like. And I will give a story. I remember being a probie, and I went to a very, very slow house in New York City out of probie school. I went to a company in Rockaway Beach, and their nickname was the Washed Up Brothers on the Beach. And the junior man used to get the nozzle. And I remember one day, I'm this probie, And, you know, I got – these guys have more time standing at the urinal than I have on the job. And they are – the junior man in the has the nozzle in the engine. And the junior man has 29 years.
Wow. That's a career.
And – oh, that's a career. That's just one of the, and he was the junior man. So there are guys with over 30 years. There are three other guys on the rig with over 30 years. And this was a four man with an officer. So five person engine company, but it was four firefighters and one officer. And the drills, they did drills according to the book. And the drills according to the book were from 2 to 3, you sat in the kitchen and you drilled. And we had a lieutenant who could make Bob Ross jealous of how monotone his voice was. And he would sit there and start reading the books like this. And then you take the fork of the hallet and put it either above or below the lock. And I was a brand new motivated young firefighter, and I couldn't stay awake. I mean, it was horrible. So, again, we have to make sure that we are getting these people the sets and reps they need, and we are not doing a disservice. Because if we send somebody to a place where there is no fire duty, where there are no drills, what's going to happen to that young man or woman in the fire service if they're not getting any sets of reps?
Oh, absolutely. And you and I both buy into this. It was funny, you know, Joe even talked about this. One of the things in the American fire service, I think because there isn't a culture for it out there, we have to get away from the company officer wanting to be the buddy and wanting to be liked. There's nothing wrong, Joe, you and I agree on this point, nothing wrong with the lieutenant saying, hey, we're going to go drill, gun on the rig, let's go, and having a plan, having the drill, having things squared away. One of the things I tried very hard to do to get buy-in from my crews was I'd look at something that, you know, maybe we hadn't seen lately, whether it was the old foam adductor or whether it was, you know, and say, hey, you know, Fred, why don't you look up, you know, whatever it is, give me a half hour on it. You know, we'll start at the table, we'll move into the bay, shoot, we'll go on the road. I'd be happy to do it. And starting to get buy-in. It even got to the point where one of my people, and he's a battalion chief in the old department now, you know, so proud of what he's done. He's made some grabs. He's done just awesome. Would call me even on a Saturday night if we were working a Sunday and going, hey, what are we going to drill on tomorrow? I want to, you know, kind of bone up on this and study up on it. And it got to the point where that was permeating on our crew. And in the suburbs, it's hard for us. I mean, you had the ghetto. You had the hood. You could probably find a half a dozen abandoned places, go in forced doors, pull ceilings, do whatever. What we wound up doing was going to, and in the burbs, there's always new construction. Always, always, always new construction going on. And we would go on a day when, you know, the workers weren't there, a Saturday or Sunday, go in, and if we were on the engine, stretch lines, you know, into these places under, you know, it's been framed and all that. It's still kind of raw, but at least we would have an idea of the hose we needed to take to the back bedroom. How much do we need to get to the Charlie side? You know, do we have a terrain issue? You know, we could throw ladders all day long because, man, they're going to, you know, they're going to finish this off with the Solitex and whatnot else. And they're not going to see some of the bangs we did on the OSP. They're just going to cover it up. But that was our training ground. That's where we could actually go out and see firsthand what we needed to do, where we needed to do it in the areas that were being built up. We did not have, well, I mean, we had a ton of townhouse apartments, and we had some row frames even, but towards the end of my career, it really started exploding where the farmland was being sold off to developers, and it was all going to be either single-family dwellings, one or two-story, or townhouse apartments, or, you know, whatever. But now we were a little bit ahead of the game as far as knowing what we needed and where we needed it. It was certainly an opportunity to get the sets and reps in. We knew we needed to pull the 200-foot pre-connect. We knew, you know, the 24 wasn't going to get it. We needed to grab the 28 off the ladder, those type of things. So to your point, it was at least realistic in that aspect.
And I think that's a great thing. And I tell the story, we were up in the Bronx. I was lieutenant up in Ladder 42 up in the Bronx. And there was a group of buildings in our administrative district that all of a sudden fences went around the buildings. And so we went up and went over there to see what was going on. You know, we're firemen. We're curious. What's going on? So we found out that the buildings were going to be turned in. There were three of them, and two on one side of the street and one across the street. And they were each six stories and 10 apartments per floor from two to six. So there was five floors, 50 apartments. And then there were, because of the lobby and the elevators and the mail and everything, there were only four apartments on the first floor. So there were 54 apartments in here. So we contacted the owner of them and said, what are you doing with these things? And he said, we're turning into a nonprofit. We're going to make them into housing for abused women and families, people escaping domestic violence. We're like, oh, okay, cool. How long is it going to take? And he goes, the permits are going to take at least a year and a half. And we're like, really? Right. So we said, well, what are you doing with the buildings? And he said, nothing. And we said, can we play in them? And he said, sure. Here are the rules. You can't break any windows. You can't cut any roofs. There is no water in the building, but there's electric. So you have to be aware of the electric. And the elevators are still running. So you can't destroy any of the electric or anything else. You can breach walls. We don't care. But you have to be aware of the electric. Okay. That's cool. So we had all these doors to force. And we could do it. Now, I will give one funny story because, of course, I go into one of the things and I'm closing the door. With the screw gun and the lock plate made out of the U-channel steel, and I screw it all in. And, of course, we get a run. And what's the run turn out to be? It's a job. And I got to unscrew it. So I learned from that point on. I always breached myself a way out of the apartment before I locked the door. Okay? Which, again, you know, was a learning curve, but I never thought about it. So, but I always breached, after that one, I always breached myself a way out. I had a second way out for me if we did get a run when I locked that door with the lock plates. But this guy let us use the building for 19 months. Then we get a call in a firehouse one day, one afternoon, and the guy says, hey, listen, we're taking the roof off next week. You can do whatever you want on the roof. We're taking
That's awesome.
Really? Okay. So we cut that roof up. We went through like 15, 20 roof saw blades. We were practicing trench cuts. We were trying different louver cuts. We were just playing. And we went through this whole thing. And we cut up the roof. We did it a lot. And it was great. It was a lot of fun. So what do you think happens? Well, the roofer shows up. And the roofer shows up at the firehouse with four cases of beer. And I'm like, are you kidding me? You want to get me fired? Stop. You can't
you
bring that in here.
You just saved me a lot of work.
He goes, you just saved me. You just made me a ton of money. Okay? Because I bid like $100,000 to take that roof off. It's going to take me like 20 grand to clean it up and throw it out the windows. But you just saved me a ton of money. I said, well,
yeah.
But we cannot have beer. He says, do you guys like Italian food? And we said, sure. And he went up to an Italian place up in Arthur Avenue, and he got us all this Italian food, and as I like to call them, raviolis, Italian sleeping pills. And we had great meals for like 3 or 4 days on this roof run. He called me for about 4 or 5 years. Hey, Mike, yeah, what's up? He goes, where's the nearest firehouse to 123 Main Street? Hang on, let me look. All right, here's the phone number. Give me a call. Hey, listen, I'm taking the roof off this building. Do you guys want to go drill there? I'm taking it off next Tuesday. You can start cutting
awesome.
It on. Oh, and so, but my point for the guys and the girls who aren't in places, and even New York City, we can't do it anymore because of the liability of going into the buildings, into the vacancy
yeah.
we used to go into. But here's what you do. Find a local roofer who's taking a roof off and say, the next time you're doing this in this neighborhood, let us know. We'll help you beforehand. Really? Yeah. We want the experience. The other thing is contact your local buildings department. Anytime a permit is issued for demolition or renovation in your area, you get notified. It's a twofold effect, a two-prong effect. You understand what's going on in the area that you are working and or volunteering in, and you also might be able to go use that building. All you got to do is ask. But
right.
you have to form relationships. And those relationships in training are huge.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you. So years ago, there was a we were right near I-70 and I-75, the crossroads of America, so to speak. And along the Interstate 75 corridor, the jurisdictions that were in that area, we all ran mutual aid together in all that Butler Township and Vandalia. There was a plan where the what do I want to call it? The development was going to go, business development was going to go next to I-75. And those departments were able to get involved because there was a ton of single-family dwellings that were being bought out so that this commercial development could go on right next to the interstate. And I can't remember how many single-family dwellings there were. And unfortunately then it was, and I don't recall accurately because we weren't part of any burns. I don't know that they were burned. Maybe they did. But, boy, you talk about the truck company ops. We were doing real-time rapid intervention operations. A good friend of mine, Mike Maul, and I, Greg Marshall was in there. We were doing some training over there with a company I used to have. And we were doing real-time rapid intervention ops, like sticking a firefighter in the attic. You know, he went up to search to see if there was any extension, got jammed up. We could cut gable ends out of roofs. We could pull ceiling. We could do all this real-time stuff to get to a member in distress and ran these real-time scenarios. And it was incredible, just the things we were able, to do at that time. One of the things, though, that struck me between there and then in the Heights when kind of the same thing was going up, farmland was being bought up, the old farmers were passing away and their descendants didn't want anything to do with farming because it's obviously hard work. But, you know, these old two-and-a-half-story balloon frame farmhomes that, you know, permeate the Midwest, and you obviously have them in, you know, Pennsylvania, New York, Indiana, pick a place, so to speak. One of the things that always got me was how little chief officers, people that would be in charge of these fires and in charge of these operations, how little they would participate. I remember a chief officer, I said, hey, we're going to run some real-time drills in this one, you know, acquired structure. You know, we'd like you to be there. You know, we're going to do this so that if we did have a mayday, you're running it, so to speak. And the response was, nah, I don't think I'm going to come up. You guys just tell me what to do when the time comes. I was shocked. I was absolutely mortified. So it was left to lieutenants and firefighters to figure out, you know, what we were going to do during these times. To that point, I think it's crucial that anybody that is going to be responsible as an incident commander is going to participate firsthand, real time, in such trainings, in such drills. Like I said, last Friday, I was involved down in Hollywood, Florida, and it was Broward County Chiefs along with the South Florida Fools. And I had met this individual before, but we didn't recognize each other because we didn't have turnout gear on. But there was a chief officer, Orlando Segura from Miramar, Florida Fire Department. And somebody asked him why he was attending. He's a battalion chief, I believe. And he says, I'm here to support my people. You know, I want to see what's going on. And, you know, and I called him out before I even started my lecture, said, if there were more chief officers like Orly Segura, and you met Mo Davis and all that, man, how much better off would we be? Because they're participatory. They're the ones we're going to look to if something does go haywire, and how crucial it is to have them involved in training, not only to determine what needs to happen, but to see the capabilities of their people. Are lines getting stretched? Or maybe lines need to be extended? You know, in the burbs, we have a lot of apartments with setbacks. We need to stretch that 2.5 and break off the 2.5 down to 1.75 just to get the distance. Are chiefs aware of this? And they have to be, you know, I'm not going to say lead by example, but lead by leading and get them to participate in all this. It's not just two firefighters or one firefighter at the company level in the hallway forcing that door, stretching that line or whatever. And somebody needs to stand up and say, gang, this is what we got to do. This is what we have to do it. It kind of goes back to something you mentioned before and that we've seen, unfortunately, a lot of. How many people are in these positions because they're great test takers? People are in these positions because they went into the bureau, rose rapidly, now they're on the line, and that's a significant issue for us in a non-metro setting, although I do think some metros have to deal with that. Everybody from the top down has got to be involved in that training. I remember vividly that we were doing some ladder drills in a strip shopping center with the aerial, with portable ladders, et cetera, et cetera. And the, you know, it came on the air saying, hey, you know, where are you? What are you doing? I said, you know, we're drilling. We're down here, you know, working some stick work. We're doing this. We need to get back to the firehouse. Oh, okay, is there something going on? Well, these floors need stripped and waxed. Excuse me? So all of us have had that challenge of somebody above us, and it's hard to inspire your people when it doesn't seem like making that hallway, forcing that door, getting that roof cut is not the priority. We've got to make sure that those citizens that depend on us, we have to drill like their life depends on us. And I think that's sometimes that gets lost. I think sometimes that gets lost.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I mean, I remember being a fireman in Spanish Harlem, and the senior man, this guy by the name of Jim Tinney, and we used to call him Mr. T. And one day we get an officer, and new guy came out of the boats, hadn't been to a fire in a long time, and he says, I haven't done this in a long time. And we said, okay. And we went through it with him, and we told him what we did, how we did things, and everything else. And I remember saying to Mr. T, you know, you believe they do this? Mr. T, they keep sending us these guys who never know anything. And he goes, Mike, they do it on purpose because they know we do our job no matter what. We'll do our job. And that's why. And this guy, we took him. We had a good job. We were on the floor above, good fire. And he was like, oh, this is great. And he was all for it. Okay. Now, I've had other guys who came in and they didn't want to be there, and they told us they didn't want to be there, and they left us. I mean, they left us, me and another guy, on the floor above without a radio at that time. And he just didn't make the fire floor. There was no ifs, ands, or buts. He didn't want any part of fire duty. And so we still did our job, but it was a little hairy because we were on our own. But again, you have to think about these things when you go through this training, and think about the people. If you're not supporting your men and women in going out and training, there's something that is definitely wrong with that. I mean, training pays immeasurable dividends, and the dividends are paid when something goes wrong at a fire. And those companies that train all the time and train and keep training, they're the ones who are going to be the ones who are going to get you out of that trouble as the incident commander. So you want to know what they are doing and what their capabilities are. And it's really, really important that from the top down, it backs those people who are out there training. It backs up their idea of how we are going to do this. And I think that is so important.
Oh, without a doubt. Going back to training and trying to find out how to get training, had an opportunity last week to chat with Jeremy Donch with National Fire Radio and everything, and he has been such a proponent of advancing, you know, hallway firemanship, I guess, as we could put it. It, for those of us in the burbs, I mean, you guys had legends that you followed. You had, you know, legendary people, the Chief DiBernardos, the Captain Andrades, like you and I were talking about. There's so many people that you built in your organization, you built upon because of what they did, how they did it, and things that permeate the fabric of your department. I also remember Bob Pressler talking about the Fire 500, and it goes back, and I can never pronounce the dude's name. I think he was Greek or something, about, you know, out of 100 soldiers, 100 fighters.
Yes.
80 shouldn't even be there. You know, they're just targets and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And you dwindle it down. And I think that is so accurate in our service. And it was you know, I was trying to bone up a little bit today about what we're doing now and all that. And I went back and I had the Audible on, and I was listening to the iconic Dennis Smith book about Report from Engine Company 82. And I had the opportunity, and just so valuable, as you and I were talking about, talking to Louis Andrade. Wow. But there was a spot in Smith's book about how he hoped people were not getting on the job. Now, this is back in the 70s, obviously, for the glory, for the accolades, et cetera. I know some of us today wonder if people are getting on the job because of the benefits and the pay and the security. And I hope people aren't getting on the job for that reason, but we know they are. You know, where does the firemanship come in? Where does the, kind of like you say, getting hooked? You know, if we can get them, that's awesome. One of the things that I experienced firsthand, like when I was talking to Jeremy, in my own four walls, in my department, it was the same thing, the same way that they had done since they had gone from a volunteer department to a part-time department to a career department. It was the same thing, the same way all the time. Same people instructing. Nothing was changing. It was only what they knew. When I started at FDIC and met people like you and Lombardo and, you know, the late Billy McGinn and Andy Fredericks, and I'm sitting there next to these individuals and remembering how we used to, you know, have pizza night at the mezzanine at the Hampton. It was, this is where we started to get our training. We'd be out, you know, going to Clearstream, and I was learning from, you know, the Greg Einsfelds and people like that, how to force doors, how to do all this. I couldn't buy that kind of training. That's probably a poor phrase, but that's where a lot of us learned a better way, a more efficient way, a safer way, even if you will, get things accomplished. You know, when I was fortunate enough, you know, for you asked me to start helping you out. Oh, Johnny Newell, the lessons I learned just from all of this. Yeah, it was incredible. It was like a whole new world was opened up. So I encourage people, you know, to get to the conferences, to, you know, whatever conference it is, just don't take somebody's Facebook rant as gospel. You've got to get out there. You got to find out if it works for you, because, you know, you going on a truck company with you and five other firefighters doesn't necessarily work for me going with three. It's a different path, but we can interpolate and figure out what works for us. So encouraging people to search out accurate and solid and good information from people who have been there and done that. And I think that's one burr under my saddle that's just absolutely cranks me, is the people out there that think they know, and they attach a cool moniker or cool name to something because they think it's catchy. And man, they've never made a rescue. They've never done a BES under fire conditions, et cetera, et cetera. But they've read a book or they think they know. Find out the people who have actually done it and absorb it from them and make it work for your operation, large or small.
I can't agree more, Dave, and I think it's incumbent on the people to do their due diligence on the people who are claiming to teach, who are claiming to be I like the word instructors, they're students of the craft, whatever. The thing about these people is you have to do your diligence, and you have to see where they came from, what they've done. And it's really, really important that you look at the people who have done it. I mean, there can be people who want to teach you the whole nine yards and want to do, you know, but they've never done that. I will be very honest with you. I am a New York City. I was a New York City guy, everything else. I'm not going to teach you grain bin rescue.
Right.
There's no way. I've seen them, but I don't know what a grain bin is. I don't know how it works. Okay, but I have friends who teach that. That's their whole thing. But they're experts at it, okay? I'm not going to teach you water shuttling, okay? Because that's not in my thing. If you go to a guy who's in a suburban community, who's the biggest store, the biggest building in their district is three or four stories, and they're teaching you high-rise operations, there's a problem. Okay?
Absolutely.
Understand who your people are, who you are getting, and do your due diligence.
Yeah, and it's the focus. You know, I'm not going to trust an airport fire person to start teaching me rapid intervention about how to get somebody out of a basement or commanding the Mayday. But by the same token, I don't know beans about aircraft, you know? All I know
right.
is if it's a red handle, just shove it in the other direction. That's all.
Yeah.
But your point is well taken. You have to find out what it is that works for your operation, that what's, you know, what is appropriate and what's going to work for you. We can, you know, read the stories. We can listen to the books, the podcasts, you know, we can do all this, but by the same token, for example, when I was fortunate enough to teach at the Mass Fire Academy and was able to be around not only great Boston Jakes and Worcester Jakes, particularly, that are fighting fire in three-deckers. Some of the suburbs had three-deckers. So they were able, while they couldn't put the same amount of people on the scene, they could take from lessons learned as far as primary placement of lines, laddering, et cetera, to at least increase their, you know, do well in their operations. You know, I have a very good friend of mine who's a I believe deputy chief in a very small suburb in Massachusetts, and I drive through their area when I visit, and I see not only three-deckers but mill buildings, excuse me, that have been converted to apartments. Whole different ballgame. And Ken's got to be able to address that with a very minute response, you know, and God forbid the EMS is out because you just gutted your responding companies by 50%. So he has to be able to figure out how to get that done and how to prevent it from, you know, making the 6 o'clock news, so to speak. But it's, and one of the things I remember, and I wish I could remember who said it, because I want to give them full credit, but I use it a lot. Firefighting is local. You know, Mark Wesseldine is out in the middle of Wyoming, I think, maybe. Totally different than where he used to ride in the city. You know, Heights is much different than Brooklyn. It's about where you are and what you have going on. When I got down here, in Florida, walked up to the place we live in now in the front door. I'm like, the front door opens out? What's that all about? You know, now I've got an outward opening door. It's okay. I could do it. But, and then I found out it's a hurricane standard. Just like we went to Sacramento 1 year to teach, and I was trying to explain how you can rip brick off of a frame dwelling in order to affect, you know, rapid intervention, being able to get inside the building, you know, take brick veneer off. Didn't work at all. It worked great in Indianapolis. It didn't work real well in Sacramento because of earthquakes, and like every fourth course is tied in. So all firefighting is local, and it depends on what you need to accomplish for the people that you're responsible for. But you have to have the accurate information to do that.
And very honestly, it is all local, and I think it's a great point. But the other thing is, very honestly, it's amazing to me because you have those small areas, like you said, outside of Boston, outside of a major metropolitan area, that have the same buildings and half or a quarter of the manpower. They still have to accomplish the same tasks with less people. And it is very interesting because they do it, but they have to be willing to do this. And these are very, very, very difficult things for these people to do. And I think it's very important that we understand that. You know, I have manpower in New York City. I have a lot of people. But if you are in a small city, I mean, we were just out in Milwaukee. And I think Milwaukee's closing another two engine companies the first of the year. And they're losing it, and they're expecting them to do more and more and more with less and less and less. And it becomes a huge issue. So, again, that is something where the training pays dividends because you have to prioritize and then do your job depending on what your job is on that fire ground. Now, another thing I just want to – two things I want to bring up. So we talk about this before. You talked about some people, okay? You know, the Chief DiBernardos, the Joey D himself, the people like Mo Davis, Louis Andre, Tom Kennedy, who was that picture that we all want to be that guy at 31 Truck when Chief Kennedy was one of my bosses in the fire department. What do you think is the same about all of them?
I believe unequivocally and fully it's about the job. It is about responding, being the best firefighter you can be, you know, making the difference, being willing to push that extra 5 feet, you know, as a good friend of mine says, 10 feet past common sense, because you're there to put yourself in between harm and the people that are about to be harmed. You know, I had some great mentors, some great friends, the late Tom Kenny out of Hyannis, you know, Stevie Gillespie, all these people that were about the job, that there's that line in The Replacements, I think, with Gene Hackman and Keanu Reeves, where he says, "I want the ball," and he goes, "All the best do. I want the ball.
All the winners want the ball. The winners want the ball.
All the winners want the ball." And that's the Louis Andres, that's the Mo Davises, that's the people you and I hung around with, that's the influencers, that's the the people that want to be there because of what Chief Croker said. And you know, without that, they're just fire department employees. There's a huge there's like Grand Canyon wise, there's an abyss between firemen and fire department employees.
I agree wholeheartedly, brother. I think you said that so well. And I think that's a great point. And I think it's something that you know, those people that we mentioned, those, you know, Louis Andres, Tom Kennedy, TK up in all of those guys, what were they? They were the foundation. They were the people we built our careers around. You know, they were the people.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Every day we stand on their shoulders. And I think that's a great, great thing. And they're the foundation.
I remember when my son was tested for your job and was accepted and everything. Unfortunately, there was the issue with the pay. But we were riding in Squad 41, and I remember going to what really sounded good, and everybody was pumped. I remember getting turned back and guys being pissed because it wasn't a working fire, and they got turned back.
Right.
To me, those are the people I want to go down a hallway with. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so another thing you talked about, and I just want to kind of go back and visit it again a little bit more. You talked about visiting a site out on drill, going out in your neighborhood or something else. I was at a place, and I won't tell anybody where. That's not – I don't want to embarrass them or anything else. But, no, their union had a rule that it was – they started at 7 o'clock in the morning, and from 7 to 8 was breakfast time. And then from 8 to 9:30 was, you know, committee work, duty time, house duties, whatever. And then from 9:30 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon was open time. They could do whatever they wanted. And after 4, they weren't allowed to drill.
Yeah.
And I talked to the union president, and I said, are you telling me that if I was the captain and we had a fire at 4 o'clock in the morning and something went wrong and somebody got hurt or could have gotten killed or something went wrong or we almost had a wreck or something else, I can't go back and talk to my people about this? Not until the next storm. And I looked at him and I said, and I quote, I said, thank God I don't work here. And he goes, why? I said, because my folder would be look like the Yellow Pages. I would have so many union points in it. Because there is no way that is a union job. I said,
yep.
You are putting your people's lives at risk by saying that I can't drill with them. After now, I'm not asking to wake them up at 4 o'clock in the morning and take them out on the road, even though sometimes they might need it, but I'm not asking for that. But I'm saying if we had a close call, I can't go back and drill on it. And he goes, nope. I'm like, not for me.
Yeah.
Not for me.
That's a bunch of crap. Yeah.
So I love those visits. I mean, we found visits at places like we found replacement doors for a place. And we would put a note in the book. And everybody, let's go look at that door they found. We've never seen that door before. Or, you know, a four-way door that locks in certain buildings. It had a lock that went out every which way. Let's go look at this door.
Yep.
One
of the best chalkboard and table talk trainings I was ever at was at a company in your department, and it was conducted at 11 o'clock in the evening. Because somebody had been detailed or mutualed or whatever to another company, had a job, and they came back and they were working the night tour, and they got everybody together and said, man, I got to tell you what happened at this job. And I'm sitting here going, and Jeff was with me. It was during that time we had stayed at your house and we had stayed at 41. And I'm like, this is awesome. This is just awesome. And everybody was engaged because they wanted to learn. They wanted to understand how to do their job better. And I'm going to put another plug-in for somebody, I defy anybody. You know, one of my absolute best friends in the world, God bless him, Bobby Swick, the Swick ladder drag that so many people have copied, and, you know, he's thrilled about that. But the video of him grabbing baby Chelsea, this is a guy who ran a one-man ladder company for just about his entire 30-plus year career, makes this grab of this infant and hands her out the window to another, you know, firefighter who actually had worked for me on the ladder. If that doesn't move you to be the best you can possibly be, whether you go out in the bay by yourself and just getting your gear and your mask on, you know, learning the tools in the compartment, just trying something new, even if you got to go do it by yourself, if that doesn't move you to be a Bob Swick, to be so many people that are that have done amazing acts, and you know, I don't care where it's from, because you know I've been looking at my my feed, and since 5 o'clock, just the places I happen to see, dozen, not only just working fires, but second alarms and dwellings and apartments, commercial occupancies, just since 5 o'clock this evening, all across the country. Yours is coming. It's, you know, it's just a matter of time. Yours is coming. And you better be prepared for it. And if you're not prepared to be a Bob Swick, to be any number, you know, of these people who have done amazing things under challenging conditions, you got to rethink what you're doing. But to those who have had the hook, line, and sinker, it's a, you know, it's like a lighthouse. It's an iconic beam that you're going to go to, and that you're going to achieve, and you're going to earn that title of fireman.
And, you know, there's one more thing I want to talk about when we talk about training, because I this resonates with me big time. And I always had great senior men when I was an officer, and I had great senior men when I was a fireman. But as an
officer,
that's huge. The senior men are huge. And I remember coming back from a job one night. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and we're beat up and all that. And I'm in just doing my paperwork, and my senior man comes into the office and he says, can I have a drill in the kitchen real quick, Cap? I said, okay, good, I'll be in a minute. He goes, you're not invited. He goes, go take a shower. Okay, so something happened,
buddy,
that I was not aware of, did not need to be aware of. He was not going to embarrass the member in front of me, but he was going to have a drill. And he was going to have a drill in the kitchen, and he told me to go take a shower. And I said, okay, I'll go take a shower and just go over the intercom when you guys are ready to go back in service, so I know we're going back in service. And I went upstairs and took a shower. The senior person in that firehouse, now mine was a senior man, but it could be a senior woman. I don't care. I have friends who are the senior person in their department, and it doesn't matter to me what your gender, what your race, what your ethnic background is.
Exactly.
If you want to be that guy or girl that leads, I don't care who you love. I don't care anything. I care that you care about that company, those brothers and sisters, and you want that company to be the best. You have that same thing that Tom Kennedy, Louis Andre, Bobby Swick, all of these people had. They had the ability to want to be the best they could be, and they always strove to get better. And that's what I'm looking for in a senior man. Could you just expound on how you feel about that a little bit for me, Dave?
You know, that's the old, if you're going to make me be the officer, then I'm going to be the officer, because I have a job to do. the right. senior member of that, and I'll go back to somebody who I mentioned recently, Jenny Grima. What a hard charger. I would take her as the senior man in my house any day of the week because she is all about the job. I had, you know, and I think what is great about the fire service is all the labels go off. All the labels go off. Like you just said, it's got nothing to do with gender, race, creed, really nothing. It's about all of us there being together, and it's about the job and about them first. But that senior man, that senior member, if you don't have a good one, you are going to be struggling. You'll get it done, but you're going to be struggling. But that senior member has the buy-in. They have, and I had some, I had some amazing senior men. You know, I had the Mike Balls and the John Perrys and guys like Dick Fletcher and all that. That they exuded the organization. You know, it wasn't about who was the boss, who had the trumpets, who had, you know, whatever. They were there to conduct the crew, to conduct the team, the, you know, it's interesting in our line of work, you have the lieutenant, the captain of the company, then you have the senior member. So you get back into that, the official or an unofficial leader and, you know, all that kind of stuff when it comes to organization. But truly that senior member is the leader. You probably had it more than I did. I mean, you would have the different senior member because you would have a different lieutenant, a different captain, you know, whether it was a mutual, whether it was just, you know, the different groups, et cetera. But that senior man was consistent through everything. They made sure the crew functioned at a level at which they would not be embarrassed. And I think that's, they cared about the crew. I think the officer has to care about the operation, but it's like a good first sergeant. I ask when I'm doing trainings, I ask people in the military, I said, tell me what's more valuable than a good first sergeant, a good first shirt. And they all say nothing. They're nothing. The care and feeding of the operation. They make sure the tasks get done. If it doesn't need to go to the boss, they take care of it. If it does, they take care of it. But that senior member is huge, absolutely huge. And if you've been a company officer, if you don't rely on that senior member, you're doing yourself and your crew a disservice. If you have relied upon a great senior member, your job's a whole hell of a lot easier.
And you have to empower them.
Oh, yeah.
You have to empower them to make those decisions. Don't let it get to me. Because I used to tell my people, if I have to make the decision, whatever decision I make, you're stuck with.
Exactly.
Okay? There's no going back.
Be the boss, if you make me be the boss, I'm being the boss. That's it, because that's my job. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it was interesting. I was talking to my son today, talking to Jeff today, promotions and about some things. And I think along with, you know, just regular line training, you and I know this from having extensive conversations with you, you have to train your replacement. It's incumbent upon you, if you are a good company officer, you have to train your replacement. Whether they stay in your house or they go somewhere else, that's immaterial. But you have to replace you. And I said, you know, are there truly any good educational materials, reading materials, et cetera, on the company officer, and I don't mean fire officer one, fire officer two. I don't mean that. The care and feeding of your people, the things to look for at a job, how to be, and I know you've done it, and I'm fortunate that I've done it as well. You go up, and you're not the first to, but when you show up, whoever's running that incident points to you and says, you, I want you, go get it done. I even had it in the burbs. You know, we would go mutual aid, and it was, as one of my fond terms are, it was a good old-fashioned goat rope. The chief would turn around and say, Dave, you know, go get it done, because I had a great crew, and he knew he could trust us to get it done. You know, I've heard it countless times in the FDNY. Trained your crew up so it had that reputation that when they showed up, the chief would look past four other companies and say, I want them, because they knew. And I think, you know, whether it's the company officer, whether it's a senior man, just the training, they knew the quality and the reputation of that crew. And I think you have to hone that. And particularly, I think in the burbs that it makes a big difference, just because we throw a lot of bodies at an incident, but the incident commander doesn't necessarily know the capabilities of who's showing up at their fire, particularly when they start, you know, calling mutual aid like crazy.
Right.
They don't know who's right. showing up. They don't know their level of training. They don't know their level of commitment. But if you make a reputation for that company, they're going to be picked to go to work. And it goes back to, how have you trained your people? How have you done that? I was very frustrated a couple of times. You know, like I said, I had incredible, dedicated individuals. I would be on vacation and I'd get a phone call that, hey, you know, there was a fire over here and they put us to work right away. And we were like second due on the second. It was like, right. Well, okay, that's great. I'm sorry I missed it, but it was the reputation of the company. And I think that goes back to the, you know, what we're talking about, honing the training the right way, all firefighting being local, is that, you know, is that where we need to be? Is that where we have to be in maintaining that focus?
I agree. And I think that you have to also, not only do you have to hone that skill, but you have to own that reputation.
Well
by
put.
By doing your job. Okay, honing it is good, sharpening the tools, but you also have to own that. This is what we want to be. We want to be the one that people are going after. So I think that's great, brother. I think that's
absolutely
great. So we're about an hour and 20 minutes in. So yeah, it goes fast. It really does.
It does. Well, I can't thank you enough, Michael. It's always an honor and a pleasure.
Now, I know you're doing a lot of stuff. You're teaching with Aaron Heller and doing some stuff with him. If somebody out here wants to get in touch with you, where can they get in touch with you, and what will you be doing next?
So I've got a Instagram page. It's called From the Hallway. And I've heard from a few people here and there. I try to, as we talked about, stay in my lane. Look, I don't know about ghetto firefighting. I mean, I had certainly the economically depressed suburbs, you know, the hood, so to speak.
Right.
You know, but I've never made a 8-shape, 6-story and all that. But try to stay, you know, with the suburbs and all that. But it's called From the Hallway. The next thing, on December 2nd, fortunate enough to go back down with the Southern or the South Florida Fools, Jimmy Russo, Mickey Tofexas, some really great guys. We're going to do some hands-on on December 2nd down in Hollywood, Florida, working with Walt Lewis, who is just an amazing individual who is doing so much with some command and control. And I love the part I play in command and control because I get to be a thorn in the side company officer kind of guy. going to be at the Orlando Fire Conference, I believe in February, and then going to be looking at the Texas Joey D in March, and looking forward to all of it because so many great people, great instructors, the attendees are awesome, eager to learn, wanting to learn, and just hope, you know, we can give them something that they can take home and be immediately usable. So other than that, that's about it.
And do you want to share an email?
Sure. Luft, L-U-F-T, 1221 at hotmail.com.
So if you want to talk to Dave about what he's doing, feel free to contact him. Check out his page and check out his email. I want to thank everybody who listened, and I don't know if anybody even did listen, but all of those listening in archive when they're doing their workouts and everything else, thank you all very much. God bless you. Dave, you and Sue have a great Thanksgiving. I hope it's the best. And I'll talk to you before then, but for our brothers and sisters out in Blog Talk Radio Land, I won't be back until after the new year. So Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, whatever else you celebrate, Kwanzaa, Festivus, whatever. Enjoy your holidays. I hope it's full of family and good times and everything is good. God bless you all. Thank you all very much. And I appreciate it. Thank you.